You're listening to According to Sam, episode 92. All right, guys, welcome to According to Sam. This is episode 92. Thank you so much for listening. I've been talking about a lot of history in the past three podcasts. I think I started giving this history lesson in episode 89. And history can be a very tedious subject. I try to give it context and to move around and to make it interesting. And even in doing that, I feel like, you know, it's just repetitive and it makes your eyes roll back in your head at times. That's just the way history is for some people. But I think that it's important to revisit the reason why I am doing a series of podcasts like this and telling this history. And hopefully that will help you bear with me and with an understanding of what the purpose is. And the reason why I am giving this history lesson is because history is absolutely imperative that we understand it right now in this stage of our history, particularly in the United States of America, but world history. In this stage of world history, it's imperative that we understand history and have a true sense of history, because history is under attack. I'm going to just go ahead and get into the clips. I'll tell you about the website and all that at the end of the podcast, but let's just get into this, because there's an absolute attack on history right now. They want to teach your children the 1619 version of American history, where the American, where they weren't even American colonies. There were English colonies. The Virginia colony was the only colony in the Americas in 1619. And the 1619 Project, and the author of the 1619 Project, want to teach your kids that that was the beginning of America, when America, the American Revolution, wasn't even, you know, fought until the 1770s, and it wasn't, the Constitution wasn't even hashed out and ratified until almost the end of the 18th century. Despite all of that known and understood, proven history, they want to teach your kids another history, the 1619 Project. They also want to teach your kids critical theory. Critical theory, it's not only critical race theory. Critical theory was developed at the Frankfurt School in Germany, and it's social theory, and it's critical gender theory, critical sex theory. It's rooted in postmodernism. Postmodernism is 100% anti-intellectual. They want to teach your kids that. And that's why I am giving the history lesson. But let's dig into this a little bit more. Now, this was on The View just the other day, and they were talking about this controversy that arose with a New York Times columnist. And the New York Times columnist was on MSNBC, and she made the comments about how she was disturbed or fearful at the sight of seeing American flags. This is the interview with the columnist on MSNBC, and then it's going to go into the ladies on The View discussing this. And I'm telling you that there's an attack on our history, and this is the evidence of it. Take a listen.
I was on Long Island this weekend visiting a really dear friend, and I was really disturbed. I saw, you know, dozens and dozens of pickup trucks with, explicatives against Joe Biden on the back of them, yep. Trump yep. flags, and some cases just dozens of American flags, which, you know, is also just disturbing, because essentially the message was clear. It was, this is my country. This is not your yeah. country. I own this.
So disturbing. So disturbing. And you look at her giving this interview, you can see she's frightened that she was driving along in Long Island and she saw explicatives against Joe Biden. It's like, yeah, you can't be flying the American flag unless you voted for Joe Biden and you like Joe Biden. Anyone else flying the American flag it's frightening because you didn't vote for Joe Biden. You know that book that Robin DiAngelo chick made all that money off of? A white fragility. This is black fragility right here. This is you little precious little fragile little flower. You can't see American flags being flown by people that have a different point of view than you. And then this idiot Sunny Hostin follows up on The View, and I want you to take a listen to what she says.
So for many, the flag has been a symbol of freedom.
The flag has been a symbol of freedom. People all over the world in despot nations, when they see the American flag, they were flying the American flag in Hong Kong. When they were doing the Hong Kong protest, they were flying the American flag. Yeah, people all over the world see when Cubans come across the Atlantic Ocean fleeing communism and Castro, when they see the American flag, yeah, it's a symbol of hope for them and freedom. Yes, it is. Sunny Hostin, go ahead.
So for many, the flag has been a symbol of freedom. Has it taken another meaning, Sunny?
Yes, it has. And I'm so surprised, actually, that she is receiving this kind of backlash. And as Megan mentioned during the last segment, you know, when someone of color, a black woman, is telling you her feelings,
people need to question a black woman
and not, you know, repudiate it and not say, well, that can't be true, because you have in many respects the former disgraced, twice impeached, one term president to thank for politicizing the American flag.
So she says that it's Trump's fault that the American flag is been politicized, and the New York Times columnist has her fragile feelings hurt when she sees Trump supporters or people who don't agree with her flying the American flag, that Trump is to blame for that. And you remember the clip that we played when we started telling this history, Don Lemon saying, Trump doesn't know his history, that Trump needs to learn his history, that American history is rooted in slavery. Remember that clip? Here it is.
Very aware of the history of this country, and we have to discuss the history of this country. And the history of this country is that it came out of racism. It came out of slavery. People who look like me did not come over on the Nina, the Pinta, or the Santa Maria.
Nobody came to America, the United States of America, the English colonies, on the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria, you idiot Don Lemon. And America is not rooted in racism, like he says. But he's saying that Donald Trump doesn't understand the history. And this is the history that he needs to understand, that we're rooted in the United States is rooted in racism. That is the founding principle of the United States, is racism, is what Don Lemon says. And that's why the woman, the New York Times columnist, is fearful of the American flag, not because of Donald Trump. It's because you are taking a crap on the history of this country, rewriting the history of this country, and you're trying to instill the fact that this country is bad, and this country was, founded on stolen land, and you know, murdered the Native Americans, and you know, enslaved a bunch of people, and that's all that America is. That's all America has to offer. That is America in a nutshell, and it is just not true. And it doesn't come from Donald Trump. It comes from the 1619 Project and stories like the 1619 Project that seek to rewrite history. Take a listen.
There are those who claim America's true founding was in the year 1619, when African slaves were forced across the Middle Passage to come to the New World. They claim that America is rooted in oppression and racism. These are the claims of the 1619 Project.
And then, so the 1619, like I was just saying, the only colony, the only English colony in the America was a very fragile Virginia colony that in 1619, it could have survived or it could have been lost, like the very first expedition that came to the Americas from England, that basically the first expedition founded the Virginia colony. They all died. And then they sent a second expedition that formed the very first colony. But it's, I mean, to say that that's the founding, this English colony is the founding of America, it's retarded. It's not true. So the debate is between 1619 and 1776 when the American Revolution started, and the 1619 Project and those who are telling the stories like the 1619 Project are that the almost 200 years that this was an English colony, everything that went on here was done under English law. That's the beginning of America. It's insane. This is the author and creator of the 1619. And listen, she's in an interview here. Listen to what she says.
In a special new issue, the New York Times Magazine is launching a series called the 1619 Project.
The New York Times, the same paper with the woman who's the columnist that I played at the beginning of the show, who said she was so fearful of seeing the American flag. She also works for this paper, the New York Times, who sponsored the special project called the New 1619 Project, which has been turned into a curriculum that they are trying to teach your children at school. It's the New York Times that sponsored this entire thing. The columnist that works for the New York Times that's afraid of the American flag, it's all one organization.
It's the 400th anniversary of the arrival of the first enslaved Africans in the colony of Virginia. The series examines the ways the legacy of slavery continues to shape this country. The Times says the project aims to reframe American history and place the consequences of slavery and the contributions of Black Americans at the very center of the story we tell ourselves about who we are.
There it is right there. They even say it. That's a direct quote from the New York Times, that we seek to reframe American history with the 1619 Project. Reframe American history
continues to shape this country. The Times says the project aims to reframe American history,
reframe American
and place
history,
the consequences of slavery and the contributions of Black Americans at the very center of the story we tell ourselves about who we are. The journalist behind the project is New York Times Magazine domestic correspondent Nicole Hannah-Jones. Nicole, good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Can you tell us about the genesis of this project? Where did you come up with the idea?
Sure. So I've been thinking about the year 1619 since I was in high school, yeah. And I came across that date in a book called Before the Mayflower.
So what's the name of the book? The name of the book is Before the Mayflower, okay? What was before the Mayflower? Virginia. There was nothing but Virginia before the Mayflower. So you got it from this book about the Virginia colony, which was the very first English colony before the Mayflower. They came over on ships called Deliverance. The Mayflower established the Plymouth colony. About a decade, a little bit more than a decade later, the Plymouth colony is a totally different colony. The people that established Plymouth were totally different from the people that the prospectors that established Virginia. The people in Plymouth came to the New World for a totally different reason than the people who came to Virginia. So she reads a book that gets her thinking about the 1619 Project, and the title of the book is Before the Mayflower. So that means before the Plymouth Colony. So history stops there. I mean, at the Virginia colony, you discount the whole Puritan culture that was established first by the Plymouth colony and their values and who these people were, and distinguishing them from Virginia. You don't do that in the 1619 Project. What's going on here?
I just was struck by how people of African descent had been here that long, and I never knew that date and never heard about it.
Right.
So as the anniversary was approaching the 400th year, I thought that this was a time to actually assess what has that legacy been, and to bring this year, 1619, to most American households where it was probably going to pass without them knowing about it.
You say 1619 is as important as 1776.
Yes.
Listen to this. 1619 is as important as 1776. See, this is why I'm doing this history lesson. This is why I'm doing the history lesson, people. 1619 is as important as 1776. 1776 led to the fight for independence in Mexico. Miguel Hidalgo said that the cry of Dolores was influenced by 1776 in Haiti, when Toussaint, when he battled the French and won independence in Haiti for the Haitian slaves. Toussaint says that he was influenced by 1776. The French Revolution, as I told you in the last podcast, was influenced by 1776. Every uprising for independence across this planet was influenced by 1776. And she's trying to say that 1619 is as important as 1776. This is why I'm doing the history lesson.
That this was a time to actually assess what has that legacy been, and to bring this year, 1619, to most American households where it was probably going to pass without them knowing about it.
You say 1619 is as important as 1776.
Yes. Our decision to buy that first group of 20 to 30 Africans would influence almost everything that would follow after.
Everything. Everything is influenced by Virginia buying Africans and starting the slave trade. Every single thing that happened in America after that was influenced by that.
The Africans would influence almost everything that would follow after. I think it is foundational. It is as foundational to who we became as a country as our decision in 1776 to break off
our decision. It's crazy. This is what's his name? Ta-Nehisi Coates. And he's a famous black writer, if you don't know who he is, but he's really good friends with this Hannah Jones chick, and he's been out defending her because she doesn't only work for the New York Times. She also is a professor at the University of North Carolina, and there's this controversy now because she is not given tenure. They gave her a 5-year contract. Like I said, she's lucky to be teaching with the nonsense that she wrote in the 1619 Project, and that she's teaching. Who would want their kids in this class? But Ta-Nehisi Coates, he is defending her here, and I want you to take a listen to what he says.
There's a much bigger debate that's going on here, and it is about what ideas our children, what ideas students at colleges will be exposed to or not. The 1619 Project has its detractors. It has its proponents. There's been a vigorous debate around it, as it should be. That's what we want in education. That's what we want in a free society.
But you don't have that. You don't have that on both sides. You don't have a vigorous debate and all ideas accepted. And I mean, what world are you living in here? What? And he says, you know, this is a battle for the ideas that your kids will be receiving and taught and indoctrinated with. That's what this is about. Listen to more of this guy.
State legislatures, when I see United States senators, when I see the president of the United States directing critique at it via an executive order, when we see laws being passed, actual policy to ban the 1619 Project. And ban
he's saying it's censorship,
theory.
That we should be allowed to, I mean, even though that it's historical idiocy, we should be allowed to put it out there and let the kids, you know, debate it and see. I mean, that's what he's saying. And I'm not talking about the romanticized part of history either. You remember when we started telling this history, we played the clip of Rick Santorum, and he only wants to tell the side of the Plymouth Colony. I always say that, you know, that the United States, the founding of the United States and the roots of the United States are in both of those two colonies. I'm not saying that this woman is 100% wrong in what she's saying and what happened in Virginia, but she's totally discounting what happened in the Plymouth colonies that started the Puritan society in the North. I mean, the roots of the Civil War are right there in those two colonies. The two cultural clashes of the people who settled in Plymouth and in the North, and how they differed from the people who settled in Virginia and in the South. I mean, as those two different cultures start to develop after the Virginia and the Plymouth Colony, I mean, it sets the stage for the Civil War. It sets the stage. And you can't tell one story without the other. You can't just focus on the South and the culture of in Virginia and the Southern states and the slave states and just totally discount what went on in the Northern states. But you can't be like Rick Santorum here and just tell the part of, you know, the Mayflower and the Plymouth Colony and the Puritans and then discount what happened in the Southern states. So you have to tell all the history. Listen to Rick Santorum here again.
They came here because they were not allowed to practice their particular faith in their own country. And so they came here mostly from Europe, and they set up a country that was based on Judeo-Christian principles. When I say Judeo-Christian, the Mosaic laws, Ten Commandments, and the teachings of Jesus Christ.
That's not true. That's not true. It's partially true, but it's not the whole story. And I'm going to tell you the entire story. And the reason that I'm doing this is because history is under attack right now. And you're going to need the answers and the tools to be able to argue against the new history that they want to indoctrinate our society with. There's a quote from George Orwell: "The most effective way to destroy people is to deny and obliterate their own understanding of their history." George Orwell. That is what the party was allowed to do in 1984 to change Oceania foundationally. The new founding fathers is what they tell you in the Purge movies. The new founding fathers. You have to dismantle the old founding fathers to create new founding fathers. The 1619 Project and what's his name that we just played, the Tassihani Coates, he even says it here, they're both together and joined at the hip. The 1619 Project and critical race theory is one of the many critical theories, social theories. It's rooted in postmodernism. Postmodernism is 100% anti-intellectual. But these are the two pernicious doctrines that are being fed to our society right now. And it's the 1619 Project and critical race theory.
Yeah, let's talk about critical race theory, exactly what it means and the calls to ban it.
Yeah, so critical race theory is a framework for understanding American history and American life, and the basic premise of it starts from the idea that racism is endemic to this society. Now, you can agree with that or disagree with that.
I disagree with it. And I don't want it in the schools, this father and this black father and his black daughter went viral last week. And you may have seen it. I'm going to play a little bit of it. It's a TikTok video and his cute little girl. And he are doing this TikTok video and they went viral. They were on news outlets. I saw them on Sky News in England. But this is the fight against the changing of our history, the changing of our society. And this black father and his beautiful black daughter, take a listen to what they said. This angered the left so much when they saw this black father and his beautiful black daughter do this TikTok video and it went viral. They hate this.
Daddy teaches you can be anything in this world that you want to be, right? Don't daddy teach you that?
Yeah, and it doesn't matter if you're black or white or any color.
Doesn't matter if you're black, white, brown, yellow, right?
Black.
And how we treat people is based on who they are and not what color they are.
And if they're nice and smart.
See, this is how children think right here. Critical race theory wants to end that. Not with my children. It's not going to happen. My baby's going to know that no matter what she wants to be in life, all she has to do is work hard and she can become that.
Work hard even though you don't know anyone. You can make friends.
This dude's like, you got me messed up if you think that I'm going to let y'all poison my child's mind. And he's taking charge. They hated it. I said that it went viral. It didn't really go viral. I didn't see him on Don Lemon's show. Chris Cuomo didn't bring him on. I didn't see Joy Reid bring this black father and his daughter on their show. I mean, it only went viral on one side of the political aisle because they don't want you to see this. They don't want you to see this. And people are fighting back. I love it. It's a beautiful thing to see. They don't want that critical race theory. They don't want that 1619 crap indoctrination taught to their kids. I don't blame them. And that's why I'm doing the history lesson here. I'm going to give you some more tools. When you go to the school board meeting, when you go, when your kids bring this crap home, I'm going to show you how to recognize this crap and how to argue against it. That's the job here. That's why I'm doing the history lesson. In 1862, Abraham Lincoln, the Civil War had started in 1861, and Abraham Lincoln meets Harriet Beecher Stowe in 1862. The war is raging. It was the deadliest and bloodiest war in American history. Civil War is always the bloodiest and deadliest war, but that's true of our American history, that the Civil War was the bloodiest and deadliest war in this history. And this war was raging. Abraham Lincoln, the president of the United States, overseeing this war. And he meets Harriet Beecher Stowe and he says that she is the little woman who wrote the book that started this great war. How could this little woman write the book that started the great war? It's because the northern states, they didn't have slavery and the brutality of slavery in their face on a daily basis because there was no slavery. Slavery was outlawed in Pennsylvania in 1777. The Quakers in Pennsylvania said, we will not have slavery in this state. They also said the same thing in Vermont. And a lot of other northern states didn't have slavery. They knew nothing about the brutality of slavery until Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote it in a book that went viral. And the atrocities in that book, the Americans in the North started saying, no, we can't allow this to stand. Abraham Lincoln said she was the little woman who wrote the book that started the Great War. Same thing in the 1950s when the television was first invented and people started having televisions in their homes. At the same time, the civil rights marches in the South were going on, and in the living rooms of these Northerners who weren't experiencing the Jim Crow on a daily basis, they got to see for the first time what was going on. It angered them. We're not going to tell that part of the history. We're not going to talk about those people. That is why I'm doing the history lesson. So I hope you understand. Even though it may be a little tedious at times, bear with me. We were talking about the people who found the Americas, the Spanish, and the people who founded the United States of America, English colonists. And I said that there were five things that you needed to understand about these people who came from Europe to find the New World and found and ended up founding the United States of America. You need to know who they were. You need to know what Europe was like and where they had come from. You need to know why they came. And the people who came to the Plymouth colony, they didn't come for the same reasons as the people who founded the Virginia colony. Two different reasons. So you have to know why they came. And then the Spanish expedition that came with the Nina, Pinta, Santa Maria, and Columbus, they came for different reasons. So you have to know why all these different people came, and we're going to talk about that. What they found and how they were greeted by the natives when they got here, and the elements when they got here, and all of that. What they found when they got here, and the religious faith of these people. All of these people did not have the same religious faith, and it's very important. So we were telling this story, and we started in the Roman Empire, and we were talking about how the Roman Empire transitions from a pagan empire to a Christian empire, and we were talking about the great Constantine and his conversion, and after he's converted, he wins the battle of the Milvian Bridge. After he's converted, he has his whole army fight under the Christian insignia, the Cairo. They win the battle, and then after winning the battle, then the Christian God is instantly famous because although it was the very first recorded battle that was fought in the name of Christianity, Constantine was victorious. So that increased the fame and notoriety of the Christian God. And then Constantine calls a council to hash out the tenets of this new Christian faith of the empire. The merger of church and state is starting to take place in the Roman Empire. And that was a story that that we ended with in the last podcast. Now, this podcast is going to be, there's going to be a lot of religion in this podcast. We're going to talk a lot about the roots of Christianity, the Christian faith, and the tenets, and how they change, because the fourth century is probably one of the most important centuries in Western culture. And the fourth century not only was the Roman Empire transforming, the Christian religion was also in a bit of a metamorphosis as well. You remember the Council of Nicaea was in 325 AD. The city of Constantinople, the new Christian city, was it was dedicated in 330. So we're going to talk about from 330 to the end of the 4th century, and then we'll probably, if we have time, jump ahead. We want to get into the Franks. So let's the first thing that I want you to understand, and I want to talk about, we're going to talk about Christianity and Christianity's roots. You need to understand who the apostles were. And the apostles were... there were the 12 disciples. Now, when Jesus was doing his ministry, he had, you know, people following him everywhere, masses of people following him. But in Jesus's inner circle, he had these 12 men that were his closest confidants, and they were basically his disciples. He was their teacher, and they were learning from him. These men have some of the most popular names in the English language, even to this day: Andrew, James, John, Philip, Matthew, Thomas. You know, these are some of the most popular names in the English language. These are the names of Jesus's disciples. Most of what we know about Jesus comes from these disciples, who then, after Jesus dies, then they become the apostles. And most of everything we know comes from these guys writing down what they witnessed. But we're going to talk about Islam in a moment. Unlike Islam, where everything that is in Islam, that is in the Quran, comes from one man. It comes from Muhammad. You have at least the four different gospels, or four different witnesses of what is being witnessed in the life of Jesus: Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Luke is a Gentile, very significant, because Luke is also going to write the Acts of the Apostles. And that is, that's the best and best documented history of what the apostles did in the Acts of the Apostles after Jesus rose from the dead and ascended into heaven, is what these guys say. It doesn't come from me. It comes from these guys who wrote it: Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John, and others. There were 12 disciples. You know that Judas, he betrays Jesus the night that he's arrested with a kiss, and then he feels guilt and commits suicide and then kills himself. So then there's only 11. But then after Jesus dies, you in the Acts of the Apostles, you have this guy Saul, who is a guy who is a he is going around persecuting Christians at this time. He is a legal scholar in the Jewish province. He's also a Roman citizen. He has a conversion, the conversion of Paul. And this happens when he is on the road to the city of Damascus. And then Paul is also, he becomes a disciple. I mean, he becomes a apostle. And so there's 12 apostles again, because there were the 11th. Judas kills himself, and then Paul has the conversion, so he becomes the 12th apostle again. And all of this is documented in the Acts of the Apostles, which is written by Luke. Let's take a listen to this first clip, and let's get back into this history.
What looks like an ordinary Roman execution will ultimately change the course of history.
So the crucifixion was really the heart of this new Christian religion.
Jesus of Nazareth is about to be crucified for claiming to be a king.
That's very important what they say here in this clip, that the reason that Jesus Christ was crucified is because he claimed to be a king. And all the Council of Nicaea, even when Muhammad comes along with Islam, it's all, and I told you this in the last podcast, all of it is about the identity of Jesus, who this guy was. The Arian said in the Council of Nicaea that Jesus was just a human who was incarnated with God, and they had two distinct separate natures. And Athanasius is the one who argued for one nature in the Council of Nicaea, one nature, two natures. And then Muhammad's going to come along later and says neither one of those natures matter, that there's only one God, and that is God, and Jesus isn't even his prophet. Muhammad, now you are his prophet. But it's all centered around the identity of this guy, and understand, as they are saying in this clip, the crime that Jesus was crucified for was claiming that he was king, actually claiming that he was God. That's what what's his name, Lion, Witch in the Wardrobe, C.S. Lewis, Lord, he says that Jesus is either liar, lunatic, or Lord, because he claimed to be a king. He claimed to be God. And that's what the crime was that he was crucified for.
Earth is about to be crucified for claiming to be a king.
The crucifixion is central to Christianity because the idea that Jesus suffered and died to expiate the sins of mankind was really the core moment for that whole theological message to happen.
With an angry mob looking on, Roman soldiers crucify him. They believe it should silence Jesus and his followers once and for all. 50 days later, the Bible tells us that same Jesus has risen, walked on earth, and ascended to heaven.
So the story of the ascension is that after the crucifixion and Jesus' 3 days of being dead and harrowing hell, he returns and he stays with his followers.
Jesus tells his closest allies to continue his mission. He says they must carry on without him.
And as Jesus is talking to them, he blesses them, he commissions them to go out to the world. After he blesses them, he's lifted up.
But the apostles are 12 ordinary men, hardly theologians.
For many of the apostles, this becomes a true test of faith because they have to believe in things that they've never conceived of before.
Without their leader, they don't know what comes next. They are waiting for a sign. Suddenly, in the flash of an eye, the apostles' mission becomes clear. The Bible's book of Acts describes an event known as Pentecost, the Holy Spirit descending from heaven.
So Pentecost is in the second chapter of the Acts of the Apostles, and what it is basically it's the incarnation of God, the communion of God and man for the first time, God being able to live inside man because the price for sin had been paid. This is Christian theology, that Jesus is the Lamb that comes to take away the sins of the world. This goes back to Passover, that the Passover lamb was slain in Egypt. This is Torah. The Passover lamb was slain in Egypt, and the blood of the lamb that was sacrificed was put on the door seal. And when the death angel passed through Egypt, this was one of the plagues to free the children of Israel from slavery in Egypt. This is the last of the plagues. The death angel passes through Egypt, and the firstborn son of everyone who didn't have the blood of a sacrificed lamb on their door sill, the death angel would kill the firstborn son. So Jesus coming into Jerusalem at the time of Passover, during Passover, and offering himself up is a type of what happened during Passover. He is the lamb that takes away the sins of the world. Once that has been done, now God can have communion with man, and the Pentecost is the first time where God comes after Jesus' death to live in men. That's what is going on here. And these men are the apostles. But it's not only the apostles. As Peter in the book of Acts, as he is, and this is the word apostle means messenger, as Peter is delivering the message of Jesus and the gospel. Gospel means good news. As he is doing that on Pentecost, the people who hear it and believe it, they're also incarnated with God. And this is the early church here that we're talking about. Now, another thing that you got to understand is bishop. Now, what is a bishop? And I want you to take a listen to this clip. This guy explains a little bit about what a bishop is, because as these apostles, as they're growing old and going from town to town to establish the Christian church and share the Christian message, they're establishing bishops in each one of these churches. And this is what a bishop is. Take a listen.
The Greek word for bishop, episkopos, has two parts. Epa, over, and skapas, a spectator. So literally, it is an overseer. It is a person who watches over others, a supervisor. Overseer and supervisor mean the same thing. I prefer supervisor because it is used more frequently today in the secular world.
So that's what a bishop is. And we talked about the word diocese. Diocese comes from Diocletian. After the third century crisis, the word actually means administrator. And as Diocletian is attempting to repair the empire after the third century crisis, he set up these subdivisions throughout the empire, which were called dioceses. And to this day, the Catholic Church has adopted the word diocese for these subdivided regions of the world where every diocese has a bishop. Now, why am I telling you about bishops? Why do you have to understand this? Because we're going to get into the feudal period here in a moment, and you need to know the entire chessboard. The game of chess is feudalism. That's what chess is. You need to know about the European dominus, absolute monarchs, the European, the king and queen on the chess piece. You also need to know about the knights that we talked about in the last podcast. These were those who the king and queen who have divine right given to them by God to rule over men. They bestow this nobility onto knights, and they carve out fiefdoms in their empires and make these knights rulers. And you have the serfs. These are the pawns. The serfs are those who live on the land and work the land in these fiefdoms. And then you also have the bishops, and you have to understand every one of these pieces to understand the feudal period. So that's why we're talking about who the bishops were. Now, after Jesus's ascension and then the descent of the Spirit of God to incarnate man. After that takes place, this is all during the first century, during the Roman Empire, during the Julio-Claudian dynasty. The Julian-Claudian dynasty ends with Nero and Vespasian. The dynasty of Vespasian basically ends out the first century. You remember Titus Vespasian destroys the Jewish temple in 70 AD. Well, in this period in the first century, after the ascension of Jesus and the descent of the Spirit of God to incarnate men, the apostles, which means messenger again, they're going from city to city delivering the message, the good news, the gospel, and people are accepting it. They are converting to Christianity. They're being baptized into the faith, and these apostles are establishing churches. Once they establish a church, they don't stay there. They move on to another city, establish another church. And after the conversion of Paul, we just talked about Paul. Paul was unique amongst the apostles because he wasn't just a common fisherman, and most of these guys were just common men. Paul, I was a little bit different. He was a Roman citizen. He could speak several languages and write in several languages. He was a scholar, again, a legal scholar. So when he's converted, his skills and his ability to write and articulate become very important. He writes most of the New Testament epistles and lays out a lot of the framework of what Christianity is. An epistle is just a letter. So there's 27 epistles in the New Testament. That means there's just 27 letters. Paul writes most of them. And his letters are instructions to these different churches throughout the Roman Empire. The book of Galatians in the Bible is Paul's letter to the church at Galatia in present-day Turkey. The book of Philippians in the Bible is Paul's letter to the church at Philippi in Greece. The book of Timothy is Paul's letter to his student Timothy. And there's two letters to Timothy in the Bible. These are just letters. That's what epistle means. So Paul lays out most of the framework for what a bishop is, what their responsibilities are, and what's going on here is as the first century is winding down, these apostles are getting old, they're being imprisoned, they're being martyred, they're dying off. There's no more apostles. So they have set up these bishops, these supervisors in these different churches, and they take on the missions after the apostles. As you get into the second century, these bishops who preceded the apostles, they're dying. So they're setting up, bishops to follow in their footsteps. And then when those bishops die, then more bishops come along. And then as you get into the fourth century, you have tons of different bishops. Not all of these bishops have a direct relationship to the apostles in the first century, and heresy starts to creep in, is the problem that we identified in the last podcast. These are a couple of passages from Paul's epistles.
Philippians 1:1 and 1 Timothy 3:2 list two positions in the church: bishop and deacons, or as I translate them, supervisors and servants.
That's not a
Titus
correct 1, translation.
Titus 1:5-7 connects bishops with elders. In verses 5-6, Paul tells Titus to appoint elders in every city. Then he starts giving the qualifications of a bishop in verse 7.
So this is all Paul's letter to Titus. He's explaining how Titus is supposed to appoint elders and what the criteria of a bishop should be. It all comes from Paul, but not only Paul. Here is Peter also in his letters, in his epistles.
Jesus is described as a bishop, the supervisor of our souls in 1 Peter 2:25.
And that is something that Paul reiterates in Hebrews, the book of Hebrews. And it's interesting because, you know, you have these two different apostles. You have Peter writing that Jesus is the bishop, supervisor of our soul. And then in Hebrews, Paul says that Jesus is the high priest. At least we believe that Paul is the author of Hebrews. We don't know quite sure if Paul is the author of the book of Hebrews, but it reads like Paul's writing. But the book of Hebrews is a very, very interesting book, and it tells you a lot about the early Christian church because the early Christian church was all Jewish. This was an offshoot of the Jewish religion. And Paul, or whoever the author was of the book of Hebrews, is writing a letter, an epistle, to Jewish Christians. As a matter of fact, the very first church council that they have in the book of Acts, the Acts of the Apostles, written by Luke, who is a Gentile, mind you, the very first council that that he is writing about in that history is a council of all of these Jewish men. All of the apostles were Jewish. All of the disciples, all of the people who followed Jesus and received the incarnation of God on the day of Pentecost were all Jewish. And then you have this Gentile, Luke, writing the history of the Acts of the Apostles, and he records this very first church council where all these Jewish men get together and they're debating if Gentiles can even be Christians. Is this can Gentiles even be involved in this, and do they have to be circumcised? Because that was the other big controversy, is that Jews were circumcised and are circumcised on the eighth day of their life. They are in the world for 1 week, and on that eighth day, they are circumcised. That is codified in the Jewish law. And all of these Jewish men had been circumcised, and they were having a debate. Can Gentiles even be involved in this new Christian religion, and do they have to be circumcised? So that was a big deal. The fact that the entire early church were all Jews. And that's something that you have to understand too when you understand the crucifixion of Jesus. It didn't just come out of nowhere. The whole idea of atonement, Yom Kippur, is a Jewish, it's not even a Jew, it's a Jewish feast, but it's all about atoning for your sins. This is very much a part of the Jewish religion. I told you about the Passover a moment ago, but even before the Passover, the very first in the Torah recorded sacrifice is when Adam and Eve sin and they're naked, and God kills a animal, and they're clothed with the skin of the animal for the first time. That's the very first recorded sacrifice. But animal sacrifice is not only Jewish religion. The pagans sacrificed animals to their pagan gods. Even when the Spanish came to the New World, they found that the Aztecs were sacrificing humans. not only animal sacrifice, human sacrifice to the gods was going on in the Americas. So that's the idea around Jesus Christ, is what Paul, or whoever authored Hebrews, says about about Jesus as the high priest, that he's the high priest, because in the Jewish faith, every year they would go to atone for their sins, and the high priest would make an atonement for their sins by slaughtering an animal. This is something that God demands of the Jewish people in Levitical law. They still do it to this day. Take a listen to this clip. This is a clip about Jews in Brooklyn. And these Jews during Yom Kippur, they are still to this day sacrificing. They bring chickens out and they are slaughtering, hundreds of chickens. This is a video of an activist who is recording this. But I want you, this is going on to this day. The idea of sacrificing a animal for the atonement of sins. Take a listen.
I want you guys to see what's going on and just listen to the screams of these animals. This is happening on public streets in Brooklyn. Public streets, there's feces all over the place.
I know.
Total animal cruelty. Now they're trying to block from you guys seeing what's actually going on. But also,
disgusting. It's disgusting. But God told the Jews, your sin is disgusting. That's what he said. He said, your sin is disgusting. That's why you have to do this, to cover for your sins. Yeah, it's disgusting. Your sin's disgusting. The sin of this world is disgusting, is what God says. So they're still doing it to this day. Animal sacrifice, even human sacrifice, is not anything new or unique even to the Jewish people. Like I said, the pagans were doing it. They were doing it in the New World. They've done it all over this planet. The things that was unique about Jesus Christ offering himself as a sacrifice, because out of all the sacrifices, blood sacrifices that have been made to the many gods on this planet, he was the first time that people 50 days later said that he came back and he was chilling with them and hanging out with them. That's the thing that made Jesus different. And that's the story that each one of these apostles told. And they went all over the Roman Empire telling this story. And as they died, like I was talking about earlier, in the as the first century winds down and all of the apostles are gone, and the bishops that preceded the apostles, when you get into the late second century, they're all gone. And then you get into the third century and you have more and more people calling themselves Christian bishops. You have the heresy creeping in, and it became a huge problem. Now, there are a lot of, when you start getting into the third and fourth century, I mean, you're 200, 300 years removed from the apostles. And by that time, there are a lot of stories told about these men, these apostles, and where they went and what they did. And not all of it was true. Not all of the stories told about these apostles are true. The one apostle who the most elaborate stories were made up about, well, I can't even say the most elaborate, because there were some pretty elaborate stories made up about these apostles to, we'll talk about why they made these stories up, but take a listen to this clip about the apostle James.
Santiago de Compostela, Spain. Here, at the western edge of Europe, a sacred shrine rises high. A church was built here in the 11th century, following an incredible discovery. Legend says a shepherd, guided by light, revealed the resting place of one of Jesus's 12 apostles. Early Christian tradition claims the apostles Andrew and Peter ventured west from Jerusalem in the early first century. But many believe St. James the Great, or Santiago, delivered the gospel all the way to Spain.
Listen to those three names. those the early Christian tradition, how early? Around the fourth and fifth century, they started telling the stories of these apostles, 300 years removed from these apostles. But listen to the names of the apostles that they claim all came west, okay? This is Peter, this is Andrew, this is James, these three.
Early Christian tradition claims the apostles Andrew and Peter ventured west from Jerusalem in the early first century. But many believe St. James the Great, or Santiago, delivered the gospel all the way to Spain.
Many believe that. Many believe that many people on a yearly basis get together for a pilgrimage across Spain. They believe that James went to Spain and that James, that his bones were discovered in Spain by this shepherd, and that today James's bones are in Spain, and they built a church on top of what are said to be the bones of the Apostle James.
And they say his remains are buried somewhere beneath these floors.
Santiago is one of the Jesus' apostles. And his tomb is here and inside.
This is the crypt containing the relics of St. James, discovered in the 9th century. And there have been two previous basilicas built over this area.
9th century. The 9th century. James would have died, you know, I mean, 800 years before these bones are discovered. There's no evidence, no evidence whatsoever that James went to Spain. There's actually more evidence that James never went to Spain than the evidence that he did go to Spain. But a lot of people believe it. They go on this pilgrimage every year to Santiago to commemorate the Apostle James coming to Spain. There were a lot of stories told about these apostles, and they weren't true. And James is an example of that. But Peter and Andrew are also two apostles where some stories were told about them and they were not true. All through the second century, because the apostles were dead and gone, that's when heresy, the Gnostics, come along. And remember, I told you the Gnostics wrote Gnostic Gospels that were extra Gospels that were not written by the apostles. And the Gnostics believed that Jesus wasn't really a real human being at all, that he was a phantom and a ghost that interacted with people and his disciples. This started in the second century, but they weren't the only ones. There were tons of heresy. That was the problem that the Christian church had in the second and in the third century, during the third century crisis, as they're being persecuted, as they are hiding and meeting in private in the Roman Empire, they're also having to deal with these heresies. And the men like Jerome and Origen and others were battling intellectually in writings and arguing against some of these heresies, but the church had no power in rooting out the heresy. The first council that is called by Constantine when Constantine converts to Christianity, and it is the Council of Nicaea to argue against the Arian heresy. And that's when the Nicene Creed is first introduced. And you remember that part in the Nicene Creed that we believe in one Catholic and apostolic church. Catholic means universal, one universal and apostolic church. They are in the Nicene Creed. They're reaching back to the apostles for credibility. basically, that we are an extension of the apostles. We're not something new, a new heresy, a new teaching that's being taught that diverts from the apostles. No, we're with the apostles. This is 300 years after the apostles, or 200 years after the apostles, in 325, when the Council of Nicaea is when they meet and hash out the Nicene Creed. But before that, these church leaders had already started thinking about how to root out heresy, and they came up with this philosophy of apostolic succession, that all of these different bishops calling themselves bishops all over and, you know, teaching things that divert from the Christian religion, those are not real bishops. The only real bishops, this is, you know, 200 years after the apostles, that they start talking about this tradition of apostolic succession. It was argued most by Irenaeus. Irenaeus was from the East, and then he moved to the West, to what is present day France, and he writes his masterpiece in Greek. And that's something else that you got to understand. We're going to talk more about this in a moment. But the empire was split into two. And in the western part of the empire, they spoke Latin. And in the eastern part of the empire, they spoke Greek. All of the epistles that the apostles wrote that made up the New Testament were written in the Greek language. It's very important. Irenaeus is a Greek-speaking bishop. He moves from the east to the west, and he writes his masterpiece against all heresies, and he writes it in the Greek language. So what he's doing in doing that is saying that we're going to root out these heresies, and I'm writing to the Greek church, to these Greek bishops, all these people calling themselves bishops. You're not bishops unless you can prove that you succeed a actual apostle in a church that an apostle founded. And these apostles founded many churches all over the Roman Empire. But unless you could prove that you are a successor, a bishop of a church that was founded by an apostle, you're not real, is what Irenaeus says. And so they start to create stories about the apostles, particularly Peter and Andrew now. And they say that Peter came to Rome, that he was the first bishop of Rome. And because he was the first bishop of Rome, that all of the bishops of Rome who succeed Peter are all in apostolic succession. But Constantine, he had just built a brand new Christian city in the eastern part of the empire. They called it Constantinople. So in Constantinople, if apostolic succession is so important that the bishop of the city has to prove that he secedes from a apostle, then it was important for there to be an apostle that founded the church in Constantinople. And very few people know about the Patriarch of Constantinople, but the Patriarch of Constantinople, the same way that the Pope claims to secede Peter, the Patriarch of Constantinople claims to secede Andrew. Take a listen.
Would it surprise you to learn that one of the world's most important Christian leaders, second only to the Pope, lives in a-
he's second only to the Pope. This is 60 Minutes. This is a 60 Minutes clip, and that's hilarious that he says that, second only to the Pope. The Patriarch of Constantinople doesn't see himself as second to the Pope. He never has. That's why there was a schism and a split between the Eastern and Western Church in the 11th century, because they both claimed to have authority because they both succeeded from a apostle. The Patriarch of Constantinople does not see himself as second to the Pope, just to let you understand that.
Would it surprise you to learn that one of the world's most important Christian leaders, second only to the Pope, lives in a country where 99% of the population is Muslim? His name is Bartholomew, and he's the patriarch of 300 million Orthodox Christians. He lives in Istanbul, Turkey, the latest in a line of patriarchs who've resided there since before there was a Turkey, since the centuries following the death of Jesus Christ.
So Istanbul, Turkey is the city of Constantinople. You can go there today. You can see the Hagia Sophia. You can see all of the ruins of the Byzantine Empire there today. It's all been, most of it has been desecrated, and the Muslims have, you know, made the Hagia Sophia mosque, and everything's Islamic now, but it's still there today. And the Patriarch of Constantinople is still there today. And the Patriarch of Constantinople claims to be a successor of Andrew. And the Bishop of Rome, who is the Pope, claims to be a successor of Peter. Now, in that latter story about Peter, I don't want to make people angry, but I have to tell the truth. I'm not anti-Catholic. I'm pro-truth. And I have to tell you the truth, that the chances that Peter came to Rome and is the first bishop of Rome, very, very, very unlikely. There's very, very, very little evidence that that took place, that Peter came to Rome. But even if Peter did come to Rome, we know that Peter founded other churches in the East, many other churches. Why would that make Rome so important? Why would that, if Jesus gave Peter these magic keys, which we're going to talk about here in a moment. If Jesus gave Peter these magic keys to heaven and earth, why is it that all the way when Peter starts his ministry in the East, all over, eastern part of the Roman Empire, starting churches on the day of Pentecost, he preaches there in Jerusalem, and then he comes all the way west to Rome, and it's the bishop at Rome who is Peter's successor and gets to inherit these magic keys and everything. It makes no sense to me. It makes no sense to me. But I want to do a little bit of reading of a passage in Matthew, Book of Matthew, written by the Apostle Matthew. It's one of the four Gospels. It's the first one, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. There's a couple of parables, and a parable is a story that has a relationship to something in reality. It's symbolic, so to speak. And Jesus, he teaches and tells these parables. And in the 13th chapter of Matthew, Jesus explains this parable about a farmer. He's a sower, is what the parable is named, the parable of the sower. And this farmer goes out and he's sowing seeds in his farm, and he's just, you know, throwing them everywhere. and he throws some in the rocks. He throws some in fertile ground. He throws some that are in some thorns. And then Jesus explains to his disciples, you know, well, this parable is about the seeds that the farmer, the sower, he's like the apostles. And the seed that the farmer is throwing, that's like the gospel, the Christian message. And he says that the farmer, the sower, he's going out and he's sowing these seeds and throwing them everywhere. And the seeds, some of the seeds are that are sown into fertile ground. They take root. They create fruit. The ones that are thrown amongst the rocks, they don't have roots that are long enough. So when the sun comes out, they wither and die. And then the seed that are thrown amongst the thorns, they're choked. And Jesus explains all this, that this the seed is the Christian message, and the sower are the apostles and those who come after the apostles who are sowing the Christian message, and the way that it is received in other people who have not accepted the message, they are one of these four different grounds that the seed lands in: the fertile soil, the rocks, the thorns. And so he explains all that. And then there's a parable that that he goes into after that, and he tells a parable about the wheat and the tares. Let me read a little bit about the wheat and the tares. Another parable he put forth, saying, "The kingdom of heaven is like a man who sowed good seed in his field." Again, it is the farmer, and the farmer is sowing seeds. Again, the farmer is the apostles who are proselytizing, evangelizing. That's what the word evangelize means. It's funny. I always laugh when they talk about white evangelicals. All Christians are evangelicals. Catholics are evangelicals. If Catholics are not evangelicals, then they're not apostolic. Because all of the apostles were evangelical. That's what evangelize means. That's what the whole thing is proselytizing, spreading the gospel, the good news, the Christian message. People believe it and are baptized into faith if they believe it. And then it says, "But while the man slept, the enemy came and sowed tares amongst the wheat and went away." The enemy, and then if you go back to the parable, that's the fourth area where the seeds land in the parable of the sower and the seeds. It says that some land in the rocks, some land amongst the thorns, some land in fertile soil, and then some land just on the roadside, you know, just tossed indiscriminately, and some birds come and eat the seeds that are tossed on the road. This is the previous parable, the sower and the seed. Well, he explains that the seed is the gospel, the Christian message. The sower are the apostles, or those who are evangelizing and going out and proselytizing and spreading the message. And then he explains what the four areas of where the seed landing are. And then now we're getting into this parable with wheat and the tares, and he's saying that again, an enemy. He explains that the birds in the other parable are Satan or the enemy, and that's who the birds represent. And he says that, you know, that they represent that once the message is given and received, that the birds come and steal the message. So again, there's an enemy in this man's field in this parable about the wheats and the tares. And he's saying, again, The kingdom of heaven is like a man who sowed good seed in his field. The seed was good. He sowed it in his field. And then while he slept, his enemy came and sowed tares amongst the wheat and then went away. So what are tares? If you have ever seen a wheat field, tares, they look like wheat. They look a lot like wheat, but they're useless. They're this hard, stiff looking type of wheat that grow among the wheat, but it's not wheat, and it looks like wheat, and it's a hard, stiff little. I used to live by a cornfield growing up, and you would see the tares growing up out of the corn. They look like the corn, but they're absolutely useless, hard, stiff. They don't really bend when the wind blows the way the wheat does, and they're useless. So this enemy comes and sows tares in the field where this farmer has sowed the wheat. Now, this is a parable. Again, the farmer is an apostle, proselytizing the Christian message. The seed itself is the message and the information that that he is sharing with people. But while the man slept, an enemy came and sowed tares within the wheat and then went away. But when the grain had sprouted and produced a crop, then the tares also appeared. So the servants of the owner came and said to him, "Sir, did not you sow good seed in your field? How then does it have tares?" And he said to them, "An enemy has done this." The servant said to him, "Do you want us to go and gather them up?" And meaning to go and gather the tares out of the field amongst the wheat. And the sower said, "No, lest while you gather up the tares, you also uproot the wheat with them." So you disturb the entire wheat field if you go and you start to root out the tares. And then the farmer says, "Let them grow together until the harvest, and at the time of the harvest, he personalizes it. This is Jesus speaking. This is red letter. I will say to the reapers, first, gather together the tares and bind them in a bundle and burn them, but gather the wheat unto my barn." So I listened to this parable, and it looks like, and it sounds like, to me, that Jesus is prophesying that as the church grows after him, that the mission of the apostles is to proselytize and spread the gospel, the Christian message, and expand the church. But in doing that, while that is being done, an enemy comes and starts to plant a different message, something that looks like the gospel message, but is not actually the gospel message at all. Heresy. It sounds like Jesus is prophesying about heresy here, and he's saying that the heresy will come, and his servants, instead of going and disturbing the field, let the heresy grow together. Then when Jesus returns, then he is the one who will sort out the heretics from the true gospel, is what I read in that. And it's funny because the problem that these Christians had in the early church was heresy, and they actively try to root it out, and they do disturb the entire field in doing so. And in doing that, they don't get rid of the heresy. The heresy just goes underground, and even after the Reformation, and people are allowed to express different ideas about Christianity, then heresy returned. So we've always had heresy in the 2,000 years of Christianity. There's nothing you can do to get rid of it. But these bishops in the 3rd and 4th century, they start to, once, and it's particularly in the fourth century, because once Christianity becomes a religion of the empire, then the bishops, they also have the military of the empire to enforce the Christianity that they say is the true apostolic Christianity. And that's exactly what happened. Before Constantine embraces Christianity and makes Christianity a religion of the empire, these Christian bishops, the only thing that they could do to root out heresy was argue against it. Argue against it and point out how it was heresy. But as you're going to see, as the Christian religion starts to become a religion of the empire, then bishops are going to be able, after the Nicene Council, and we have a Nicene Creed, and this is not only the creed of Christianity, this is the creed of the empire. It's the creed of the empire. And then after that takes place, then these bishops, the hierarchy in Christianity, the religion of the empire, they're going to be able to call the military to force people to comply with them, is what they're going to be able to do. So one of the things that they did to enforce the will of the new religion of the empire, the Catholic Church, was to raise up these bishops in these major cities as, you know, the authority on everything that was Christian. And we've already talked about Irenaeus and against all heresies, and the fact that he, and it wasn't only him, are laying out the idea of apostolic succession, and the fact that these bishops had to succeed from apostles to have relevance in the Christian church. But one of the things they did were really elevate these bishops in these major cities in Constantinople, in Rome, the bishop in Antioch and Alexandria in Egypt. They were also very important bishops, but they started to assert themselves as the final word and what the Christian tenets are, what it meant to be a Christian. And this is about the time when the Bishop of Rome starts to elevate to a more important position throughout the Roman Empire and in the Catholic Church. I'm going to play this clip. This guy is a Franciscan monk. And again, you know, I'm not anti-Catholic. I am pro-truth. This guy is a Catholic. Again, he's a Franciscan monk. But he is going to tell the story of how the position of Pope, the papacy, started to develop as not only one of the important bishops in Christianity, the most important bishop in Christianity, the Bishop of Rome. You even heard the guy on 60 Minutes just say that the Patriarch of Constantinople is second only to the Pope. And this idea starts to develop in the fourth century. And this guy explains a little bit about it. Now, everything that he says is not true, and he leaves some stuff out. I'm going to stop, you know, and kind of elaborate on what he says. But he's pretty honest about the development of the papacy and what's going on here. Take a listen.
When most people think about the Catholic Church, the first image that comes to mind is the Pope. And why wouldn't it? Popes have often been the most influential figures in the history of the Church, promulgating doctrine, leading nations, and kissing all the babies. And yet, when we look to the early history of the church, such a figure seems absent. There's no central leader of the whole church, no one claiming primacy, and certainly no one using the name Pope or Supreme Pontiff until hundreds of years into church history.
I mean, that's all true. This guy's a Catholic. He's a Catholic, and everything that he says is right here is 100% true.
And yet, when we look to the early history of the church, such a figure seems absent. There's no central leader of the whole church, no one claiming primacy, and certainly no one using the name Pope or Supreme Pontiff until hundreds of years into church history.
All true. All 100% true.
While some will point to this as evidence that the papacy was made up years later, Catholics will argue that, like our understanding of the sacraments, dogmas of the church, and even our relationship with God, some legitimate and original aspects of the church take time to develop. When looking for a foundation for the papacy in Scripture, Catholics will often look to the Gospel of Matthew. And so I say to you, you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of the netherworld shall not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven.
That's the magic keys there that I was telling you about. And listen to what he says. He says that when people are looking for a foundation in the apostles' letters that made up the epistles, which became the New Testament of the Bible, he says that when Catholics are looking for a foundation for the papacy, when they're establishing the papacy into what it is today, hundreds of years later, they looked at this letter, Matthew, that we were just reading out of with the parable about the sower sowing the seeds. In this same letter that Matthew wrote, the people who sought to prop the Pope up into what he is today went to this passage in chapter 16, and this is the foundation for the papacy. And it's all rooted in the fact that Peter was set apart from all of the other disciples. He was, the first amongst all of the disciples. He was the head guy of all the disciples, and that Jesus gave to Peter these magic keys. And then because Peter was the first bishop of Rome, then the bishop of Rome, whoever that is that follows Peter all the way up until today, Francis, sits on the throne of Peter, is what he says, that they are given these magic keys as well. It doesn't matter that Peter established many other churches, and there's tons of evidence that he never came to Rome. This is the story that they told, and this is what this Franciscan monk is saying here.
When looking for a foundation for the papacy in Scripture, Catholics will often look to the Gospel of Matthew. And so I say to you, you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of the netherworld shall not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Nowhere else in Scripture do we see an equivalent statement from Jesus about any of the other disciples, and taken together with the other Gospels, we see a consistent theme of the prominent role of Peter among the 12.
That's not true, taken together with the other Gospels. No, you mean you see Peter denying on the day that Jesus was arrested. Jesus tells Peter he's going to deny him three times, and he says no, and Jesus denies him and even cusses a guy out and says, I don't know the guy. Denies him three times. Peter's always sticking his foot in his mouth, and even at this passage, let's read a little bit of this passage in Matthew, and let's start at the beginning, because the people who want to prop the papacy up to what it is today, that want to use this passage, they only focus on a couple of lines in the interaction that's going on here with Jesus and his disciples. But we're going to start at verse 13 in Matthew 16, and this is where the entire interaction with Jesus and his disciples. He wasn't talking only to Peter. Peter steps out and is the first to answer, as he is in many situations, when he grabs the sword and cuts off the centurion's ear on the night that Jesus is arrested. He's extremely type A is what Peter is. He is the one who will act first, answer first. He is instinctive. So Jesus asked his group of disciples a question, and Peter is the first to answer, and Jesus addresses Peter. Jesus asked the question about his identity. That's what all of the heresy is about. That's what all of the question is about. Who is Jesus? And Jesus asked his disciples, who do the people say the Son of Man is? And then the disciples as a group, they start to reply. Some say you're John the Baptist, reincarnated. Others say that you are Elijah, who has come back. And still others say that you're the prophet Jeremiah, or that you're Jeremiah or one of the prophets, is what it says. All of these people are speculating. They're following you around. They're seeing you work these miracles and do these things in your ministry. And they're speculating about, who is this guy? And Jesus asked that question, who do they say that I am? And they say that some say that you're Elijah reincarnated, some say, or Elijah that has returned, John the Baptist reincarnated, Jeremiah or one of the other prophets. And then Jesus personalizes it, and he speaks directly to the apostles, and he says, but what about you? Who do you say that I am? Asking his disciples and the men who are the closest to him and walk with him every day. Who do you say that I am? And Simon Peter answered, you are the Messiah, the Mashiach, the Son of the living God. That's what Peter says. And Peter answers Jesus' question and said, you're the Mashiach, you're the Son of the living God. And then Jesus replied to Peter and says, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah. Ah, I love it. I love that this passage here is used to bolster up the Bishop of Rome and the title of Pope and the whole papacy to this day. And it says right there in this letter, Jesus replied, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah. Why? Because son of Jonah is a title. It's a title. In 2007, the filmmaker, documentarian, James Cameron, he did this documentary where they promoted it, the Tomb of Jesus. We finally found Jesus's tomb. 2,000 years later, the Romans couldn't find it. The Jews couldn't find it in the first century. Everyone's looking and trying to find Jesus's tomb. What happened to Jesus? And 2,000 years later, James Cameron had found Jesus's tomb. It was actually a documentary being made about these ossuaries. Ossuaries are little small tombs that they used to use in the ancient world. And they're basically, after your body, you die and your body decomposes, they put your bones in these little tombs called ossuaries. These ossuaries, they first started to be discovered in the 1950s by a group of Franciscan archaeologists. And then they continue finding them. They found a few more in the 1980s. And these ossuaries, I mean, like everything that these letters talk about, the apostolic letters that became the epistles, all of this stuff is confirmed in the, I mean, people that like they talk about this one guy whose name is Simon, who helps Jesus carry his cross, and they find his ossuary, and it's proven, you know, by the inscriptions on the ossuaries that this is the Simon that helped. Like a lot of this stuff that they find confirmed confirmed at least the people in the narratives that are written by the apostles. But James Cameron decided he's going to promote and do this big documentary about one of these ossuaries that was inscribed with the name Yeshua. Yeshua is the way you say Jesus in Hebrew. Yeshua, there's no J in the Hebrew language, and the J to form Jesus it came from the Germans, but Yeshua is basically Joshua, and Joshua Yeshua in the time of Jesus was a very, very, very common name. A lot of these names were common, and the way that you know who these people were is because the titles that they give would be, you know, Simon from this city or this town, or Simon the son of Jonah, like the title that Jesus gives Peter here in the 17th verse of the 16th chapter of Matthew, Simon, son of Jonah. So that's how you know who they are, because they all have, you know, the same name, but they don't all have the same father, all from the same area. So a lot of these people, the scholars who had reviewed these ossuaries before James Cameron had made his movie saying that he found the Jesus ossuary or the Jesus tomb, people had already looked at this and said, look, you know, Joshua is a very common name. That's, you know, there's no evidence that this is Jesus's tomb. And it's ridiculous when you think about it altogether. Just the fact that 2000 years later, James Cameron found Jesus's tomb and people in the first century couldn't find it. It's just absolutely ridiculous. I want you to listen to a little bit of this clip about these ossuaries, and we're going to listen to James Cameron.
All this changes in 1980. In the Jerusalem suburb of Telpiut, 2 miles from the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, archaeologists uncover a 2,000-year-old tomb. It has strange markings, unlike anything previously discovered. The archaeologists remove 10 limestone ossuaries, or coffins, from inside. Then the tomb is cemented over, an apartment complex built on top. But in 2007, filmmaker Simha Yakubovich rediscovers the tomb.
It's unbelievable. This is it.
A new analysis of the archaeology leads Simha to a startling conclusion. He's convinced that he has found the Jesus family tomb. He bases his radical theory on the fact that 6 ossuaries found in the tomb are inscribed with names associated with Jesus and his family. There is a woman called Maria Mene. This is a Greek version of Mary. It's been suggested that this unique spelling is associated only with Mary Magdalene, one of Jesus' most celebrated companions. There is also a Maria, Mary in English, a name identified with Jesus' mother, and a Jose, a nickname associated with one of Jesus' brothers. Most surprisingly, in this cluster of names, there is also a Jesus, son of Joseph. Though the implications are shocking, some scholars are open to the possibility.
Yeah, scholars looked at it, and scholars were not open to the possibility. James Cameron was just trying to make a little money on Jesus's name. Here's James Cameron in his own words. Take a listen.
Now, I've never doubted that there was a historical Jesus, that he walked the earth 2,000 years ago. But the simple fact is that there's never been a shred of physical, archaeological evidence to support that fact until right now. I think there will certainly be those that will say that we're attempting to in some way undermine Christianity, and that's really, really very far from the case. I think what this find does, and what this film does, and what this investigation does, is it celebrates the real life existence of these people this man who 2,000 years ago had a vision and communicated it to people, and in a viral way it spread.
He said he was God. And that's what this passage is all about here, where he asked his disciples, who do they say that I am? Who do you say that I am? Peter answers, you're the Mashiach, son of the living God. That's who he said he was. He wasn't just, you know, some nice guy who said some nice things. He said that he was God. And the reason that I'm bringing this up is because when these ossuaries were first discovered at the foot of the Mount Olives, and this is the 1950s discovery, there was an interesting ossuary that nobody wanted to talk about, and that very few people talk about. I wonder why James Cameron didn't make a movie about this ossuary. But this ossuary, there's little doubt about whose bones are inside this ossuary, because the ossuary is it is inscribed with this title, Simon, son of Jonah. Simon, son of Jonah. You only see this title in two places in human history. In the letter that Matthew writes, in this passage, in this scripture, Simon, son of Jonah. And then you find it also on this ossuary, Simon, son of Jonah. So those are probably Peter's bones in that ossuary that have this title, Simon, son of Jonah, that were found at the foot of Mount Olives. And the reason that people haven't heard about it, and the reason James Cameron didn't do a movie about this ossuary, is because how can Peter's bones be discovered at the foot of Mount Olives and also be at the Vatican in the St. Peter's Basilica? It's impossible. It's impossible. And it is very likely that Peter never went to Rome. And this is a story that was made up like many others. And you say that, well, even if the Pope and the Bishop of Rome is not the head of the church, he is still the head of state because he is the head of the Vatican. Where the papal states came from? The papal state, where does that come from? The donation of Constantine, which was a forgery. They forged that to create the papal states. We're going to talk about that probably in the next podcast. But let's get back to this passage here in Matthew. Peter answers, you're the Mashiach, the Messiah, son of the living God. And Jesus replied, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by flesh and blood. Peter doesn't even get credit for the revelation. Jesus says, you know, that this didn't come from you, that this wasn't something that came from flesh and blood, that you just being so smart and being so awesome because you're Peter, that's why, you know, you're saying that I'm the Messiah and the son of the living God. He says that this was not revealed to you by flesh and blood, but by my Father in heaven. My Father in heaven has chosen to reveal my identity, who I am, to you, and you answered my question correctly. And then I tell you that you are Peter, and that's when Jesus gives him the name Peter. His name Simon. Simon Peter is the name. And on this rock, I will build my church. Very important part. I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock, I will build my church. Is that saying that he's building his church on Peter? It's insane to even think that. To think that Peter is the rock that the church is built on. What is the rock? What's the foundation of the church? The foundation of the church is the identity of who Jesus is that was revealed to Peter. That's the foundation of the church. Jesus's real identity, his identity of being the Mashiach, the Son of the living God, that identity is the foundation of the church. I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock, my true identity, the Messiah, the Son of the living God, I will build my church on that. Now, the Catholics will tell you that Jesus says to Peter that I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I'll build my church. That Peter is the foundation of the church. The guy who denies Jesus three times on the night that he's arrested. The guy, we're getting ready to read here, the guy that Jesus actually calls Satan. He looks at him and calls him Satan. Peter does a complete transformation on the day of Pentecost. But again, that's not Peter. That's Peter being incarnated with the Spirit of God. So back to the passage here. I tell you, you're Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell, Hades is what it says, will not overcome it. And I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven and earth, and whatever you bind. Is he just talking to Peter here? Or is he again addressing the group of disciples together? That I will give you the keys of heaven and earth, and whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loose in heaven. Then he ordered his disciples not to tell anyone that he was the Messiah. All the way, it goes back to Jesus's identity. Jesus is the subject in all this. The question starts off with, who do they say that I am? They answer, they say, you are this, this, and this. Who do you say that I am? And then Jesus answers, and then Peter answers correctly. And then Jesus says, blessed are you that it was revealed to you who I am. And then upon the rock of who I am, I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not overcome it. And I will give you the keys of the kingdom, talking to his disciples. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose will be loose in heaven. And then he ordered his disciples not to tell anyone who he was. Why did he tell them not to tell anyone, for who he was? Because he was getting ready to deliver himself in Jerusalem and show himself to be. He was going to show them who he was. You don't need to tell anybody who I am. I'm going to show them who I am. That's why he didn't want anyone to tell. But it's all about Jesus's identity. And then they go on. Here, we're on the 21st verse of Matthew chapter 16. And from that time, from the time of having this conversation and about who he is and who, ending the speculation amongst the disciples, I mean, you all know who he is now. After following him in his ministry over a decade now, we understand and realize that this is the Mashiach. And the Jews had been promised the Mashiach for over 1,000 years. So the Mashiach is somebody who they were waiting for. And it was revealed to Peter who Jesus was, that he was the Mashiach. And the disciples started to accept him as such. And then it says on verse 21, from that time, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders and the chief priests and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed on the third day. Must be killed, and on the third day be risen to life. He's telling them, he's predicting everything that they said after the fact happened. He's predicting it right here. I have to go to Jerusalem. He goes to Jerusalem during Passover. He presents himself as Mashiach, as king, and then he is killed, and then he says, and on the third day be raised to life. And then as he's teaching his disciples, okay, you understand who I am and what I must do Peter takes him aside, and it says in the 22nd verse, Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. No, Lord, he said, this shall never happen to you. We're never going to let this happen to you. And Jesus turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. You're a stumbling block to me. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns. He calls Peter Satan. And Jesus, this is the same passage. This is all in the same passage. Get behind me, Satan, is what he says to Peter, because Peter is saying, no, we're not going to let you go to the cross. We're not going to let you be crucified. On the night Jesus is arrested again, Peter grabs a sword and he tries to fight the Romans and cut off one of the centurion's ears. He is dead set on preventing Jesus from going to the cross. And Jesus turned to Peter and says, get behind me, Satan. Now, how could Jesus say that this guy who he's saying that get behind me, Satan, you are a stumbling block to me. You don't have in mind the concerns of God. How can this guy be the guy who's the foundation of the whole church? None of that makes sense. And if this doesn't make sense, the papacy doesn't make sense. The entire papacy doesn't make sense. Let's listen to more of this Franciscan monk here.
Peter wasn't exactly writing encyclical letters from Rome and speaking on behalf of the whole.
No, he wrote no letters from Rome. Why? Why didn't Peter write any encyclical letters, any epistles from Rome? Why? If he went all the way to Rome and he was so, you know, why are most of all the epistles in the New Testament, why do they all come from Paul? If Peter was so influential.
He's credited with intervening and settling the argument at the church's first council, the Council of Jerusalem. And yet, Peter wasn't exactly writing encyclical letters from Rome and speaking on behalf of the whole church. As important as he was, we can also find plenty of examples of Peter sharing authority, being overshadowed by Paul's leadership, or even being rebuked for erring.
Exactly.
By no definition of the word can we say that Peter saw himself as a pope, at least not in the way we understand it today.
No way that Peter saw himself as a pope. And what you're trying to put on Peter, you know, years and years, hundreds and hundreds of years down the line, and you're trying to impart this, you know, authority on Peter. Peter himself would have told you, no, don't give me that, you know, place of authority, because it's not true. Peter would have told you that.
Shattered by Paul's leadership, or even being rebuked for erring. By no definition of the word can we say that Peter saw himself as a pope, at least not in the way we understand it today. The first major shift in the development of the papacy came in the mid-4th century.
Okay, right. That's where we are. Where are we at, people? The mid-4th century. The first major shift came in the mid-4th century. Why in the mid-4th century? It came in the mid-4th century because that's after Constantine united the empire under the Christian faith and made the Christian religion and a religion of the empire, and put his army and his military and the authorities behind the Christian church. And this is in the 4th century is when the first major shift starts to happen with the papacy.
The first major shift in the development of the papacy came in the mid-4th century and was actually a result of a civil rather than theological matter. When the capital of the Roman Empire moved from the city of Rome to Constantinople in 330, it left behind a host of problems and a political vacuum.
We're going to talk about all those problems that were left behind in the western part of the empire. We're going to talk about all that in the next podcast.
Rome to Constantinople in 330, it left behind a host of problems and a political vacuum. As civil concerns grew and the city faced outside attacks, strong popes like Damasus, Innocent I, Leo I, and
Damasus, let's talk about that guy. That guy Damasus became the bishop of Rome in 366, the middle part of the 4th century. And Damasus is the first pope that really starts to, or he's the first bishop of Rome that really starts to assert the bishop of Rome as the head of the church. There's some controversy in his election to be the bishop of Rome, and he calls the authorities in. He's the first bishop to call the Roman authorities in to put down dispute. You know, people were killed. It was this big ordeal. And then Damascus, after all of that, that clash with the people who were trying to get another person elected Pope, and it causes this clash, and Damascus calls in the authorities, and people are killed. After all of that, Damascus becomes the Pope, and then he starts to do a lot of things to assert the Bishop of Rome. He commissions the Latin Vulgate, which is really important. I told you that the western part of the empire spoke Latin. The eastern part of the empire spoke Greek. All of the epistles from the apostles were all written in Greek. So Damascus, he commissions Jerome to create the Latin Vulgate. And this is translating the Greek epistles into the Latin language. Then he mandates that all of the liturgical ceremonies, all of the church services, the communions, they all have to be done in Latin now. It's really interesting that Damascus does this and translates the Bible into Latin because he mandates that everything is done in Latin at this time, because the Latin language starts to die out, and later on in Europe people don't even speak Latin anymore, and it's not a common man can't pick up and read Matthew and pull it up on their phone the way you can today, and you know, Google the passage we just read and look at it and say, no, this passage is about Jesus. It's not about Peter. They couldn't do that because the language is hidden in this ancient Latin language. And that's how the Catholic Church for years and years kept the canon, and canon means ruler or not ruler like a ruler over you, ruler like a measuring stick, that's what canon means. So the canon was hidden from common people, and you had to understand canon law. You had to understand Latin. As a matter of fact, when Luther and Tyndale and others start to translate the Bible into common language, they're all chased, and Tyndale is even burnt at the stake for the simple act of translating the Bible into a common language. But Damascus is the one who commissions the Latin Vulgate. He also mandates that the celebration of Jesus's resurrection, it's Easter. This is the Easter controversy. In the eastern part of the empire, they celebrated Jesus's resurrection with the Passover on the 14th day of Nisan on the Jewish calendar. But Damascus mandated that everyone needs to celebrate Jesus's resurrection on Easter. And Easter, if you notice that they fall around the same time every year, Passover and Easter, but Passover is always on the same day in the Jewish calendar every year. And Passover can fall on a Monday. It can fall on a Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Well, Easter is the 40th day. I think it's the 40th day after the first lunar cycle, the way that it goes. So it's all set on this lunar cycle, and it changes every year. And then they count it out, and then it falls on that Sunday after the 40th day. Damascus is the one that mandated that everybody celebrate this day on Easter instead of the Passover day, the 14th day of Nisan, that they did in the Eastern Empire. And these are just a few of the changes that Damascus made in the middle of the 4th century to assert the Bishop of Rome. And it's going to carry on. We'll talk more about this in the next podcast. You really, you have to understand this stuff to understand the history that I want to tell you about the people that found the New World and founded the United States of America. And if it wasn't important, you know, I wouldn't, you know, be giving you all of this religion and all of this foundational history. But you have to understand this. You have to understand the Pope. We're going to talk about the Franks and the deal that the Franks make with the Pope to prop each other up. We're going to talk about that in the next podcast. We're going to talk about Islam. And you guys just bear with me. Thank you so much for listening.